Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 221, Tibet House Conversation with Chris Grosso.
Chris Grosso, how are you?
Bob, hello. Thank you so much for having me on, and I'm well. I'm super excited to be here with you today.
Well, that's really great. I'm very happy to have you. I did read your Dead Set on Living.
Thank you for
which
that.
I really like. I like the title because from my work of translating the Book of the Dead,
yes,
and then it talks about the Book of the Dead and the Between, I have an expression that I really like. You know, we have a concept of, you see it on the media a lot, the living dead, you know,
yes,
that idea.
Yes.
But then I like the dying lives. I'm fond of the turning that around into the dying life.
Right.
Which is what we have going, you know, we're dying all the time in every minute, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So I really liked it. I thought the title was really good. Dead Set on Living. I misremembered it as Hell Bent on Living.
It's interchangeable in a way, but yes, I like that set. Yeah, yeah.
Dead Set is even better, even better. So that's great. Are you working on a new book?
Yes, actually I am. And this, I haven't talked really to anyone about it, but I'm glad you asked. I am. It's tentatively titled We Are Not Saints. That's a working title. I am finishing up the proposal right now, but it's geared towards teens and young adults. I do for 15 years, aside from writing and speaking, I've been working with teenagers, children, young adults, anywhere from ages 5 to 20. And the majority of them, I do a lot of work in residential programs. So with teens that struggle with addiction, suicide attempts, eating disorders, self-harm, anxiety, depression. And what I found over these 15 plus years of working in that field is there's so much that's misunderstood or not understood that these teens are going through. And I'm sure you're aware, I mean, everyone's aware of this opioid epidemic that is just taking the nation by storm. It's been here, but it, you know, it wasn't until it found its way into the more rural suburban area.
Well, I know, because it's finally hit the white world.
Exactly.
It's hitting in the black world for a long, long time.
Yes, totally. So, I've taken kind of these 14 or 15 major points, I think, that are often either misunderstood or overlooked or not talked about in the most skillful way amongst adults. And I've been engaging.
That would improve me. I'm not nearly as knowledgeable as you are. So do you want to give us a few of the points, or do you want to preempt your book?
No, not at all. It'll actually, like I said, I'm still like formulating it. So this will probably help me while I'm thinking through it. But I mean, I do have the outline of it. But yeah, we're talking about things like, or I am discussing things in there. I think the first point was essentially, how do teenagers, you know, learn to be their authentic selves while they are being pressured from parents, teachers, therapists, whomever, you know, of course they're coming from a loving place, but it's like they're pressuring them to do this, do that.
Right.
For example, I was just talking to, he's 17, a very, very intelligent young man in the residential program I do a lot of work at. He's in the top 5 percentile of, I forgot what the exact words were, but, you know, intelligent students in his school district.
Right.
He got a scholarship in alternate energy and engineering to the Navy, but he's wanted to be an artist and a teacher. And all of, you know, his parents, his guidance counselor, they've been pressuring him to go do this other thing because they're like, you know, you could do so much more with your life. You have this intelligence. And he's like, that's really made me feel me and my feelings and my vision invalidated. And essentially it caused him down the road or led him to the road of depression and then drugs and ultimately to smoking crack. And now here he is in a residential program. So that's an extreme case, but things like that, I believe, could be avoided if we are talking about this more and more importantly, listening to these teenagers and young adults. And so that's what kind of the main focus is listening and getting feedback from them and trying to convey that to the parents. So it's a book both for teenagers, you know, so that it's relatable to them and also for parents. So yeah, that's the vision. And I'm hoping for a 2020 release on that.
Oh, good. That'd be great. Well, the sooner the better.
You know?
I recently was interviewed by Reuters because nobody else in the Department of Religion at Columbia would talk to them. And they came to talk to me about these Gen Z, they call it.
Yes, yeah.
Precisely these people. And their whole interest was, of course, that they were operating from some evangelists, you know, or the Pew Foundation.
Yeah,
that they're not going to church and they're atheistic, and why is that? And
right.
It's like history, why they don't believe in God.
Yeah.
And I don't know why they talk to me as a Buddhist, but we don't really believe in the creator God. We do believe there are gods, but not one who can be blamed, you know?
Yes.
Not one who mainly can be blamed.
Yeah.
And it seemed to me that, but I don't know really how to talk to them. I have had, you know, teenagers, of four of them, but they're grown up now.
Right.
And I now have some teenage grandchildren.
Yeah.
It seemed to be actually pretty cool, but
I don't,
there's a lot of stuff about them that I really don't know, and it's really, really important.
It is.
What you are doing, I feel.
Well, thank you. That means the world to me, especially coming from you. And I also want to show you and just give you my respect, because I know in speaking through our mutual friend, Beth Grossman, she has told me how passionate you are about this topic. It's so important for the younger generation to find a connection to something, you know, and you're right, that Pew study, I've been reading that for several years, and a lot of people are atheistic or agnostic. And so what I look at myself,
well, that's not a bad thing.
No, not at all. My fiance is an atheist, and I mean, she believes in, you know, more, she leans more towards the physics side of things. Like, there is something, of course, greater than us. And I have a total respect for that. We actually agree on a lot. But there, what I find is, regardless, these teenagers and young adults are looking for something more. And unfortunately, a lot of the older teachings from the great wisdom traditions aren't quite relatable to them. So what I'm trying to do is kind of be a bridger in a way to help offer them and meet them where they're at, and also help them look at where their passions are and incorporate a spiritual viewpoint, like whether it's art or sports or literature. I mean, to me at least, I believe you can find a very spiritual experience in all these creative expressions. So if we need to start there, let's start there.
How do you define spirituality, by the way?
I was on a podcast yesterday, and to me that is as loaded of a word as God can be. So, you know, for me, there, and I'll take a page from, I think, our friend Ken Wilbright, a mutual friend, I believe. But Ken talks about spirit, how with the capital S, as it imbuing everything. And you can intertwine that word or interchange that word with, you know, anything else, but consciousness. To me, they're interchangeable. But in my own direct experience, and that's all I can share, I never claim to have any answers. I can only tell you what this body-mind mechanism has experienced. To me, it truly does. This consciousness imbues literally everything. You know, regarding me, this computer we're talking on, it all comes, it's all manifested from, if we're speaking, you know, from physics, from all the subatomic particles that then, you know, take form. Right, exactly. But I also have to recognize my own limitations. The human mind, while as brilliant as it can be, can only go so far, you know, and I have to, for me again, just speaking for me, I've had to come to a point where I have to accept that everything is not always going to make sense. You know, I mean, you look at physics and And of course, there's so much wacky, weird stuff there. And I love wacky and weird, so that's why I enjoy reading it. But yeah, so I don't know. To me, spirituality is everything. That's me.
Where does compassion fit in that consciousness?
Ah, yes, a wonderful, wonderful question. First thing I want to say, anytime the word compassion comes up, I use that as an excuse to say this. I was having a lovely discussion with Andrea and Stephen Levine. And, you know, as you know, Stephen passed away. One thing they said to me, I will never forget. And, you know, it's a dream of theirs and a dream of mine now as well, is they said, could you imagine if every school, starting wherever, whether it's here in the East or the West, or maybe it's already in the West, but in third grade, let's say they taught a compassion course, like basic writing. Could you imagine if at a younger age they were teaching that? It was like a light bulb, like, yeah, why aren't they? And I know a lot of people think that's taught at home, but again, in my work for years with so many young people, it's not taught at home. For me,
by example, it is taught, but I think they're not consciously taught.
Right.
You know? And then, of course, not taught, actually, even unconsciously in some homes, unfortunately. Yes.
Yeah, so absolutely. And so going back to your question, again, my own experience, it's interesting, like, that I find we are all born with our own unique genetic imprint, you know, and we have our, and not to say that we can't learn certain behaviors, because of course we do. But I feel like certain things like compassion might be more of an innate quality in certain people, whereas frustration might be more of an innate quality. It's just part of their genetic makeup and their learned behavior and what they've been exposed to. Right. But that said, that again, that does not mean that one cannot take up a practice of loving kindness or meditation and learn to cultivate compassion or a greater sense of compassion. Donald Trump, for example. I mean, you know, not to get political, but I can't stand him. But what I try to do is, yes, I get frustrated when I hear him speak and talk, and I will notice sometimes, seriously, my fists start to clench a little, and my chest tightens and my stomach tightens.
Yeah.
But what I try to do is, that's a perfect time to work on compassion. So what I what I really do is, when I look beyond the shell of Donald Trump, you know, up there, you know, trying to be this big man, what I'm really seeing is a scared 7 or 8 year old boy, someone who was probably neglected as far as emotionally as a child. I don't know much about his childhood, but I see that coming through him as an adult. And in taking that viewpoint, not always, because it can be very difficult, but it does often help me to soften my heart towards him and towards the people that support him and are very, you know, anti-religions and you know, just to be honest, ignorant towards a lot of things. So my in-laws, as a matter of fact, or soon to be in-laws, are Trump supporters, which baffles my mind, because my fiance is just like me. She couldn't be farther from that. So we have agreed, they are lovely people, but we've agreed when we get together, religion and politics, we just don't discuss, and things work out. So
That's good.
Yeah,
that's good. And she, well, she's does she consider herself sort of rebelling against him? Does she herself, as a child, have been arguing with them and so on as a young person?
Yeah, definitely. She was very much like me, kind of a black sheep in her family. But similar to me as well. It was hard to see at the time, but I think that really helped us to, as we got older, to really look deeper at life and become more in tune with what's going on inside of us, and not allow what society or mass media feeds us to dictate what we listen to, what we like, what we believe. And you know, that's a lot of what Buddha said, like, essentially question everything, find out for yourself.
And that's really good.
Yeah. And so, I think that's definitely been very beneficial. I turned 40 this year and I still feel like a
teenager.
Oh yeah. Thank you. I'll tell you, Bob, it's nothing short of a miracle that I'm here at 40, but I am here, and that's another
reason. I know. I was amazed when I read your Dead Set on Living, how many ups and downs you had, and how you weathered them all.
Yes.
Honestly, chronicled them. I really was impressed about that.
Yeah.
You seem fine there now.
Today, it's literally, not to be cliche, but it is. It's a day at a time. I mean, with anything in life, it's a day at a time. But especially for me, when it comes to my contingency on health and well-being. I really do. And I have to take it one day at a time. And that helps me with my spiritual practice, you know, being in the moment. So
I think your spiritual practice, therefore, is actually very tied up with compassion, and that you're dealing with young people who really need someone. So your first point in the new book, to come back to that, you really need someone who will listen to them.
Yes.
And who will honor what their own vision is about their, and instead of push them into like money-making profession.
Right.
This is what you should do because this is what I did. You know, parents tend to do that, fathers and sons and mothers and daughters. And so when the kids want to have a different vision themselves, it's often difficult for them.
Yeah.
In that light, you know. Yeah. I often get people who come to me and want to be graduate students who are lawyers and engineers, computer scientists, and they want to study Buddhism or they want to study spirituality. And after they're already successful, when they have the time and the money to do it, and they don't too much lament that they didn't do it when they were younger.
Yes.
But they and they bring to it because they if they start in their 40s, like you, late 30s or 40s, they bring to it this long pent up desire to do something different.
Mm.
But they do sometimes say, "Gee, I wish I could have started this when I was 20."
When
I graduated from college, I think.
Yeah, and I feel fortunate that for me, I quite literally stumbled onto the path in my early 20s. I mean, like literally, it was my addiction brought me to my knees, and and it kind of forced me into searching for a way to find something more. And again, going back to my teenage years, like I am grateful that not even just that question everything mindset, but growing up in starting out with alternative music as a teenager and then punk rock and, you know, these underground things that were talking about more than just like money and fame and cars. Like they were talking about real world issues. And so I found, you know, once I started that spiritual exploration, I already had that inquisitive and open mind going into it, an open heart. And I'm forever grateful for that. So, and I think that's another way that makes it easy for me to connect with those young adults and teens I work with, because I just come in with the same attitude, an open heart, an open mind, open ear.
Right.
And again, I want to meet them where they're at and let's connect where we can and go from there. And seems to work out pretty well. I mean, like I said, 15 years now doing it. So
That's great.
Yeah.
So what's your second point with the young people then? After you listen to them and you try to fit with their view, move them in direction they want to go.
Right. There's so many, but another one, and this isn't in an exact order, but another one that just comes to mind, which is so important because again, a lot of the work I do is with the teenagers that are in a residential setting or have struggled with addiction, depression, et cetera. But is helping them, and they also remind me that they are not just their diagnosis. They, of course, they may live with depression or anxiety, or they have had addiction issues, just very much like I have, but they are more than just that diagnosis. And in speaking with them, a lot of them have come to realize, and some of them already realized before I even told them, that by constantly being told by their physician or their parents, you know, you have this or that, and you know, them really forcing that on them, they will then start to believe, okay, I am my depression, and then limit themselves to, I'm just a depressed teenager. And then that will lead them down this spiral in a lot of cases, similar to the gentleman I mentioned before, to drugs or to self-harm or to acting out sexually or any number of things that are not healthy for them. So, helping them to recognize, okay, yes, you have this diagnosis, but you are so much more than that. And again, I have to remind myself of that, even at 40 years old, like I still will have depression come up at times and anxiety, and I have relapsed in my life, and it's so easy to go back. You know, the brain, a part of my brain is wired to go back into that, oh man, I'm an addict or I'm depressed, or that the old self-loathing will rear its ugly head. Now I'm able to use it as a reminder or a pointer to, all right, here's where there's work that still needs to be done.
Right. So do you use meditational methods at all?
I meditate every day. Absolutely. A big one for me which when I'm asked like, what is help? Cause I used to cut, I've attempted suicide a few times. I had very low self-esteem. For me personally, the biggest impact any meditative practice has had on me is that of loving kindness, you know, working with metta practice. And I remember when I first started, I would start with myself, but I would do it very quickly. And then I would move on to, you know, the other people in the practice. But as time went on, I started forcing myself to really anchor into my heart and sit there and try to cultivate that sense of love towards myself. You know, why am I not just as deserving as others? And so that has really helped. And I try to do that practice at least 3 times a week. And then it'll vary from whether it's just mindfulness breathing to Vipassana. Right. I try to mix it up, to be honest. That's what keeps it fresh.
Right. So would you use that when
it keeps me engaged? I go in 5 or 6 times a week. Yeah, surprisingly. Like, so I'll go in and I'll do an icebreaker, and I usually I do about 3 or 4 workshops a month with this one demographic of individuals here in Connecticut at a program. We'll start out with an icebreaker, and then we'll kind of just have this like organic discussion. And it's very relatable because it's hard for you to see, but I mean, I'm covered in tattoos and eye piercings, and that right off the bat kind of
catches. Your tattoos on your arm.
I mean, head to toe, like covered. And so right off the bat, like they're paying attention, and it's like, cause they see like, okay, this guy is interesting looking. And then when they hear, I think, you know, they recognize I'm coming from a place of their level. Like I make sure to sit on the ground. It's nice. It's actually, it's in a yurt. They have zafus. We all sit in a circle, and there's no hierarchy there. I make it very clear to them. I am here with you, not above, not, you know, I'm with you. I am one of you.
That's great.
And yeah.
That's a great thing for teacher. Teacher should always be learning while teaching.
Exactly.
And letting the students know that.
Yeah.
Instead of pretending to be above them and know more than they do and all this kind of thing.
Honestly, Bob, and I've told them, I've been very transparent. Sometimes, if not a lot of the time, I learn more from them than I think they do from me. You know, I'm grateful for that. But yeah, so towards the end of our session, once I've established, you know, we've let our guard down, there's that vulnerability, that trust has been built. I'll do various kinds of, whether it's a 5-7-8 breath meditation, a body scan. Often I'll bring my guitar and I will do a music. I'll play ambient, just acoustic guitar. And I'll say lay down and try to focus in on the chords you're hearing, the notes you're hearing, and see what that does. Pay attention to your body. And just like a simple music meditation. So,
that's, you know, awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, I am a musician. That's what I've been doing forever. And so I try to, anytime I do a workshop or I speak at a conference, if I do a breakout session, I try to find a guitar, because I find a lot of people don't get access to just this live ambient meditation. And I was out, I know we definitely have a mutual friend in Alex Gray, and I've done a number of workshops at COSM, and I'll always bring my guitar there. And I will never forget the first time several years ago, I did a workshop there. I ended with a guitar meditation, and I didn't know Alex and Allison were in the room. It was my own workshop, and we were doing a Q&A panel at the end, but they snuck in at the end without me knowing. And afterwards, Alex came up, and it was my first time meeting him. And as you know, what a soft, transparent, just gentle soul both he and Allison are. But he brings up his sketchbook and he says, I hope you don't mind, but I did about 5 sketches of you while you were playing. And it was just like, I mean, I don't do the starstruck thing, but he is definitely my favorite artist. And to see, you know, these sketches of me playing guitar that Alex did was just
totally cool.
Yeah, it was. It was so incredible.
It's really nice. I love his work.
Absolutely. Both his books and his art. He is just, he and Allison are such a treat and such a gift to this world.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, you know, I want to ask you very much. I recently read in the Atlantic magazine an article about the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, and his condemnation of industrial civilization and his demand to do from jail. He puts out all these things about, you know, how people should fight it and destroy it and it's ruining everybody and this whole, you know, really serious thing.
Oh yeah. I followed that case.
What shocked me is that a lot of young people seem to be attracted to this.
Yes.
Have you ever, and I wanted to ask you, have you ever run into that?
Oh, there's
somebody wants to like to wreck everything and
yes.
Go back to nature and blow up the power grid and this sort of thing. You know?
Right, the very anarchistic.
Anarchistic thing.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm very concerned about it because the statistic in the article was that quite a lot of young people are interested in that.
Yes, and I don't know anyone personally.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yes, I know a lot of spiritual activists, which is a completely different thing. You know, they are coming from a place of consciousness, of social awareness.
Protest.
And I think there is something very honorable about that. But,
yeah,
you know, I think recently in like Paris, you know, with the yellow jackets, I don't know the whole story, or the yellow vests, where there were peaceful protesters. But then you have the people that show up just to like throw Molotov cocktails or set things on fire. Yeah, it really is. It's what point are you trying to convey? What is that actually helping? And it's like it comes back to the Trump thing for me. It's like instead of arguing with I know it's different things, but instead of arguing with a Trump supporter, I would much rather have a conversation and try to understand, why do you support him? What is it? Where are you coming from? I want to dialogue instead of, you know, like get in a fight or just yell at each other and swear at each other. Or, you know, when it comes to nature, instead of really, you know, like just going out and firebombing things. No, let's actually let our voices be heard in a way that someone will listen. And I guess maybe these people feel like maybe some of them have tried that route and they didn't feel heard and they got frustrated.
Yeah.
That's not an excuse at all. Like I said, I don't know any of them. I'm just kind of, you know, playing this conjecture there, but it is troubling. You're right. And I mean, we've already got global warming. We need to worry about this other stuff.
I know. So I'm glad to hear that. I was just trying to check, since you're working with these young people, these Gen Z people,
yes,
all the time, that it's not a major current as far as what you've encountered.
I'm very relieved
to hear that. The magazine writer was really pushing it, I believe, a bit more maybe than he needed to.
And to be honest, it could be that, I mean, I travel a lot and speak all over, and I can't recall running into it, but maybe part of it is because I'm over here on the East Coast, and maybe it is bigger in other states or other areas that I haven't really traveled to. I know it happens. We've seen it on the news. You know, we see these protests that get out of hand. To the 60s,
They ruin the regular peaceful protesters, and then everybody thinks they're all like that. You
know? Exactly.
Oh, good. I'm very relieved to hear that. That's good. What about this Jordan Peterson guy? I heard he was like also very big with your young people.
I recognize the name, but I'm having trouble placing.
Well, that's good. Then maybe don't need to get into that.
Okay.
But I saw he did, apparently he's very, very popular. Some book he wrote, which I can't remember the name of, but initially he wrote a lot of things on Quora.
Okay. Yeah.
A lot of answers, and then the Quora answers aggregated, and then he wrote a book. And he's some kind of, he's like a Dan Brown's character, you know, that the symbologist or whatever you call it.
Right.
On the good side. But then I was a little bit shocked that he's again on this total materialist side, you know, scientific materialism is it, and dominance hierarchies. And yet he's very popular with young kids, you know. So he's encouraging them to show dominance, you know, this kind of thing. I was a little bit put off by that.
No, I'll have to look them up. But I mean, to me, like that brings to mind people that sound similar, but in a healthier way, like a Sam Harris. I like Sam Harris's book, Waking Up. He said some controversial things, or Dan Harris,
Harris, of course. He's totally cool.
Love Dan. Yeah. But also, happier. Yeah, Dan's great. The 10% happier. I think that's a very accessible, much needed book in today. And I feel like I take a very similar approach. I know he does lean a little more towards Buddhism than I might. I lean definitely towards Eastern, but just general Eastern traditions and teachings.
Right.
But I mean, hey, whatever works. Like
Christianity is Eastern.
Absolutely.
Eastern Mediterranean.
I'm so glad you said that. You're right. And people here obviously forget that. So yeah, you look at the centering prayer that Father Keating made so popular, you know.
I know, dear Father Keating, he just passed away.
Right? I know, not tragic, but very sad for me. He was a very big role model for me in my life.
And he was a friend of Sasaki Roshi, you know, the famous the Los Angeles guy.
Yes.
Who died at 108 not long ago.
Yeah.
And Tai Uno, who used to teach, also Japanese American.
Yeah.
Who used to teach at Smith College.
Yeah.
He used to take Father Keating and take the Japanese Zen master to Father Keating's monastery in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And they used to meditate. And then Father Keating asked him to lead the monks, the Cistercian or Benedictine monks, in a session, you know, a longer retreat.
Right.
And the Zen master refused unless he could wear Father Keating's abbot's outfit.
No kidding.
And Sozaki Roshi is about 5 feet tall.
Yeah.
And Father Keating was quite a rangy, tall guy.
Sure.
So he dressed up, and they dressed him up in this big, long, black thing. And then he said they had to see him in the robe, the monks, to come and meet him as part of the retreat. So they would see him as a kind of authority figure within their own subconscious. And apparently, and that's where Father Keating got his start, doing Zen, you know. But then he made it Catholic, you know. Some of the more conservative Catholics didn't like that he was borrowing from Buddhism, but it isn't from Buddhism. It's just Zen. It's the tools of using your consciousness, you know, in a certain way, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Becoming more self-aware and aware of others and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I love
it.
Yeah, agreed. And I look at a lot of those more mystic Christians, and I love, like, you know, you have St. John of the Cross or Meister Eckhart, and I read their
work. We have Merton recently.
And Merton, exactly. And you read their work, and to me, there is so much intersection. And that's why I love, like, Merton and Thich Nhat Hanh. They had their conversations, and of course, they're not saying the same thing, but there is a lot of intersection between the two. And I think that's so beautiful when we can find those commonalities and come together in the spirit of that, rather than my beliefs are right and yours are wrong. And
I know that's just so sad that people continue with that.
Still.
Well, that's my only complaint about Sam. I also like his work very much, Harris. Yeah. But I think he tends to overlook like communists, you know,
sure.
and like the ideologies. In other words, secular ideology people can get just as fanatic as religious people.
Agreed.
And, Stalin, Mao, you know, they killed quite a few people.
Oh, yes.
It wasn't a religious crusade. It was that ideological crusade, right, of communism.
Yeah.
And people could go crazy over capitalism or patriotism or whatever. It doesn't always have to be religious.
Oh, yeah. I know, 100%. You know, while we're on this topic, Bob, I know it's your show, but I'm curious about what you think. You know, we mentioned Father Keating and his recent passing, and we've lost some other great teachers recently. And obviously, Thich Nhat Hanh is getting older, and Ram Dass and Pema, a lot of these great light bearers that have been holding the torch, you know, they're getting older, and there's like a younger generation starting to step up. And I'm curious about your thoughts on this, the generational shift and what's happening. And from your viewpoint, what are you seeing going on?
Well, I don't know. I'm also on the, you know, in Tibetan, when you're over 70 and someone asks you, how are you?
Yeah.
One of the things you can say is Ma Shi Zhang La.
Okay.
And that means just barely not dead.
Wow. So there's that.
So,
okay.
I think a lot of us are getting like that.
Mm.
And whether we're more or less healthy on some surface level.
Yeah.
So we're. But that also gives you a certain view. And of course, as you know, in traditional societies, the grandfather or the great-grandfather often was the one who passed on things to the very small childlike generation.
Right.
But in our nuclear family society, we don't really get much connection to the grandparents. You know, many people don't know their grandparents. And so I guess we're just kind of a bunch of grandpas and grandmas. And I think it's key that the younger generation has the benefit of that view that you have after many more years of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, we still have a lot to learn. And, you know, age does not necessarily bring wisdom.
Right.
Sure. It might bring sort of resignation, et cetera. People can carry depression with them into old age and so forth. So I think there's no rigid rule, I think, about it. And I think it's very important that the younger teachers should connect well to the older ones, and that there's a sense of passing on something. You know, I think that's very, but you yourself mentioned Stephen Levine and others.
Right.
And you had that good fortune. That's what, how were you brought up, by the way? Were you originally Catholic family or?
No. I feel fortunate that while my parents believed in what would be considered the traditional God of here,
Christian.
Yeah, but I was never forced to go to church. I was never forced to read the Bible. And I'm really grateful for that because, when I did stumble onto that path, I did not have any stigmas or dogmas or, you know, like just a resignation towards certain things because it had been forced down my throat.
Right.
And that's what I find with so many teens I work with, or when I do work with people that are in rehabs or detoxes. I had done addiction counseling internships, and a lot of people are so adverse to these 12-step programs because they use the word God. And I get that. If you've had a bad experience with it growing up, I understand that you are going to be closed off.
Right.
So I feel like a lot of parents have inadvertently, sometimes maybe intentionally, but like made the job of teachers of today a lot harder, because I find you have to kind of go in and uninstall that program that the generation before them put in, and then you can start to work. But
uninstall, I like that. Or you can upgrade. Yes.
Oh yeah, or upgade. All right, right. Yes. So whichever way you look at it. But yeah, so no, unfortunately I was not raised really anything, and I am grateful for that. So
Right. Me too. A little bit. And although they're a little bit tried in my case, but it's just it never made sense. So I kind of like the Buddhist thing where they don't kick out God, but they relativize it.
Yes.
In other words, they don't go total to the scientific materialist extreme, that dogma about how there's no spirit and no mind and no consciousness.
Right.
It's just, we're just biological robots in a meaningless, accidental universe that in which we are lost. We're briefly there, and then we just return to a state of non-existence.
Right.
I think that's really negative.
Yes, agreed.
I don't know if you noticed the editorial written by Michelle Alexander in the New York Times about maybe 3 weeks ago, maybe a month ago, where she said she didn't believe in the former and future life, but she wished, she thought maybe it would be good if people did believe in it, because then these people who are doing business as usual as the planet is going down the drain.
Yeah.
Would feel that they're still going to be there even after death. They're going to come back in a messed up planet.
Right.
And so that it would be necessary to get people to be more responsible.
Right.
About the state of the world and the planet if they felt they weren't getting away from it just by dying. I was really impressed and pleased with that. And I wonder if that's a theme, but probably it's a non-starter with the young people, I guess. They would think this is the soul or Christianity coming after them or Judaism or whatever their ethnic background is.
Right.
You probably can't get into that at all, I suppose.
We usually don't. That's, because that is a bit of a more intermediate to advanced conversation, I think, especially with younger people. It has come up, and some people have an established viewpoint, though, again, those things can change as they grow older. One thing I absolutely love is whenever I watch Ram Dass and Sharon Salzberg banter back and forth, and very playfully, but talking about soul, no soul, reincarnation. I was in Hawaii a few years ago when they were they were teaching, and I know you were just there recently too.
Ram Dass was very happy with me because I said you can have a soul, it's okay. Buddhists don't mind soul.
Yeah, right.
There is a traditional habitual Western Buddhism is too focused on the no soul, and there are a lot of them who think that the anatma or the no self is confirming materialism. Mm. And there are unfortunately quite a few Buddhists, particularly Zen ones, who feel that materialism is confirmed by Buddha. He was like just ahead of the game and he agreed with materialism, but actually he doesn't.
Yes.
Because rebirth is a really important element in the worldview. And at least, without bothering them with God, but I wonder if the young people would think about having a future beyond. I think also it's helpful in suicide.
Yes.
People who tend to get suicidal. The idea that, they're going to still be there, whether the body is there or not. There's going to be finding other bodies. So if you go into a dream.
Right.
Like when you have a dream, your regular body is sleeping in bed or hopefully somewhere.
Right.
And And your mind is active in an environment that is a virtual environment that your mind creates.
Yeah.
And still there is a body, although you're usually unaware of your body in a dream, right?
But of course. Still,
you have a vantage point. You have a perspective from a certain, you know, reproduced visual seeing. You hear sounds, or you smell things, etc. Rarely in a dream, but you do.
Yes.
And so I think that idea that it could get worse rather than everything could be solved by blowing your brains out, I think is a very important one.
Absolutely.
I once made a joke. I was with Rick Warren in a conference.
Yes.
You know, that fundamentalist preacher.
Yes, I do. Yes.
And we were on a panel together. There were a bunch of other people too. And I was talking about the materialism is so loony that they think they can become nothing.
Hmm.
So, you know, materialism thinks nothing has been discovered and proven.
Right.
That mind is nothing. So when your brain stops, then you're nothing again.
Right.
And I always love to challenge them because they will say, well, what's the proof of former and future life? They say, and I say, well, excuse me, that's, we could talk about that, but I first like to ask you, what's the proof of nothing? Can you prove nothing? Can you prove that it's there?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, nothing means it's not there, right?
Right.
Nothing is the one thing that we know ahead of time is not there and never is there, right?
Right.
It means what is not there. Therefore, no one can get into it.
Yes.
It's not a place waiting for you.
Yes.
You know? So anyway, I went out like that. Then I would say to Rickard, I said, well, you know, people in Asia, we Easterners, we could have many shots in the future, you know, after we die. If we didn't do it quite right this life, we have to come back and deal with it.
Right.
I said, but you guys, you only have one, I said, you know.
Yes.
One shot.
Right.
But you know what? It's probably okay because it's really long.
That's right. I love that.
He really liked it. He laughed. He laughed like mad. Then he wanted to, he asked me how I could set up a meeting with the Dalai Lama.
Jeez. Well, I'm glad.
It didn't work.
That's great. And I'm glad. I think this is incredibly important. So the way I try to sneak it in there is without actually talking about afterlife or reincarnation is I won't reference like Nagarjuna, but I will bring up like, in a more relatable way, like the two truths, you know, the truth of ultimate and relative. So
right. That's very good. Really?
Yeah. It's like, so he said, it's not one truth is more true than the other. They're both, it's two truths. And so, you know, we'll talk about things. And that's what I love is most teenagers that I work with do have an open mind. So we can talk about the tangible manifest world that we can touch and feel.
Yes.
But then we can also talk about the things that are unseen but are still there, that again, leaning towards the physics side. And when we start talking about that, then we can talk about energy and how literally everything is made up of energy. And what is the one thing that can never be destroyed? Energy. It can be shifted and changed. So, you know, we'll talk about, well, so what does that mean? You know, when your body ceases to exist, this incarnation, what happens to that energy? So, and I kind of leave it there because I don't want to go too far and I don't want to, you know, point them in a certain direction. I want them to find or go, you know, question it and start to come to their own conclusions or see where that will lead them. But just plant
those
seeds. That's
a beautiful way to do it.
Yeah.
I do think it's really important. You know, it's funny. It took me 40 years of arguing with materialists to finally realize that the key thing that really gets them thinking is, how can they be counting on being nothing?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is, I think a lot of suicides have to do with, like with addiction, right?
Sure.
Heroin, sort of small, you know, high dose of heroin do kind of knock you out, and are they anesthetic, right? It's basically a painkiller. So it's anesthetic, so you kind of escape from your anxieties and your physical pains through it. And then the idea then is if you kill yourself, then like they do, too many young people do, that you're going to the final, you know, trip, heroin trip of becoming nothing, and you'll never wake up.
Yeah.
And the point is that the worry that you might wake up and you might have a big headache from where you had the press to pull the trigger there, you know?
Absolutely.
It's important, actually.
Oh, yeah, it very much so.
It might make people pause who are on the brink of doing something, you know, to themselves, you know, harmful. So I think, I you know, in the death and dying thing, in the hospice movement, I've always tried to make that contribution.
Absolutely,
to people to realize that, because I think it makes people more responsible.
Yes.
to themselves and to other people, you know?
Yeah, and, couldn't agree more.
And without mentioning religion or Buddhism or Christianity or anything, could be native people, you know?
Yeah.
Judaism actually believes in rebirth, actually, you know, metempsychosis. You know?
Yeah.
And all of the Mediterranean teachings did at some point.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So what's your third point now?
So where else could we go with that? I'm trying to think.
I love the guitar playing. I think really great. Do you have your guitar there? No.
I do. I have a few guitars actually. Yeah, in the background. Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm never without a guitar. Well,
you know, in the Tibetan Saint Milarepa, who became a Buddha. Oh, yes. I'm sure you know about Milarepa.
Yes. Oh yes.
Well, before he became Milarepa, his name was Tubaga, which means delightful to hear. Mm. And he had a great voice, and he was a singer. He was a musician.
Yes.
And his mother, in fact, scolded him because they'd been dispossessed. Mm. And he was going around singing and going to bars, you know, and then singing, and everybody loved to hear him sing. And she scolded him that he should go and learn black magic and get revenge against the evil people who had taken away their land and all.
Yeah.
And then he did that, right? But later he became enlightened. So then he would sing his teachings.
Yes.
So he didn't use a guitar, he just sang.
He would always
put one hand like this up by his ear, and he was listening to his inspiring muse, you know, or his guru.
Yeah.
And he would hold his hand up like that, and then he would sing whatever teaching it was, you know, he would do it in song.
Yeah.
So that's really good.
Yeah, and you know, chanting, like Tibetan chanting is always called to me, and even sometimes I'll listen to like Baroque music, and that, I don't know, appeals to me, even though it's very monotone, but there's something, like I'll never forget the first time I heard a Krishna Das album. It was just,
it is awesome.
Amazing. I had no idea what he was saying. It was very early on in my path. I think I took a CD out of the library because I'd heard Ram Dass, or maybe I was listening to Ram Dass talk or Reading Beer Now or something, but I learned about Krishna Das with Ram Dass, and I took the CD out of the library and I put it on, and I will never forget, Bob. Like, it's just like it cut right through my heart center, and I teared up, and it, I don't know what happened to me, but it was such a beautiful experience. And
past life affinity, you know, we would say karmic affinity.
There you go. Yeah.
So how about, can you sing your 16 points or 15 points?
Sure. I actually can. I'm going to pull them up right now. I'm just going to, because I don't know, honestly, all of them 100% off the top of my head, but I will, they are right here. Let's take me one second. Pulling it up. And as I listed them, they're not in a specific order. They were just like, as they would come to me, I would put them down. And and I'm sure, like, as I'm working on the book with an editor, you know, to make it flow smoother, we will change the order of these. And maybe some will combine, some will change, maybe something new will come up. But as I have them.
The key thing about them that's so cool is that you use them all the time with actual young people who are actually helping.
Yes.
So they are really pragmatic. And that's what I like about
it. Yeah. This literally comes out of many, many years of work. And so it's all based on like direct experience. It's not just,
absolutely,
here's what I think. It's no, it's like, this is what at least my experience has been. As I have them, one is identity, which we discussed earlier. Right now for chapters, I'm just using one word, but I can elaborate on any of these. But for the most part, it's just one word. But one is identity. Two is accountability.
Uh-huh.
Three is authenticity. Four is stress, dealing with stress.
Uh-huh.
Five is death and loss. Six is sex. Seven is mental health part one, which covers depression, anxiety, self-harm, suicide. And then eight is mental health part two, which is addiction, such as drugs, alcohol, social media, sex, video games, etc. Nine is relationships. 10 is bullying. 11 is sexual orientation. 12 is uncertainty, or as Pema would say, learning to be uncomfortable with uncertainty. 13 is emotions. 14 is help, or learning to ask for help. And 15 is two adults. 15 is strictly teenagers sharing ways in which, whether it's parents or teachers, have interjected themselves in their lives that have been counterproductive to their well-being. But also, I challenged them, and I was so happy with the fact that they were willing to get vulnerable. And the second part of that was, after I, you know, they had no problem listing many, many ways, you know, in which they felt that their parents or teen or teachers had, you know, just wrong, not wronged them, but ways in which they could have been more skillful. But I challenged them, and I said, okay, and how, going back to the accountability thing, what role do you think you played in that? How do you think that you may have handled this situation a bit better so that it might have made their job easier? So it's you know, like I said, it's a book for both teens and parents. You know, I have teens first and foremost in mind, but since there's so much feedback from the teenagers, I, you know, I want these parents to read it. But aside from that, I also have, like, you know, Sharon Salzberg is also contributing some stuff to it, and some other people, some musicians and relatable people to them, more popular musicians and actors. And so, you know, so it'll kind of their attention to see some of these names they know. And that's the point. And out of the book, I'm working on a curriculum that I really want to create something that, a book is one thing, but what I find, Bob, is when they leave the residential, they always leave with an aftercare plan set up, whether it's outpatient treatment or therapy or a combination of things.
Right.
And a lot of these young adults, I tell them, please reach out to me. Let me know how you're doing. Good, bad, otherwise, I'm here for you. And I'm honored that a lot of them do. But the one thing I find is that they're like, you know, I'm doing this aftercare stuff, but I almost feel like it's a punishment. Like, I have to do it. So out of this book, I'm trying to also create an actual curriculum and program that could be a form of aftercare, but not just for people that have been teens in residential, any teens that are looking for something more, something to help them empower themselves and be more of service in their community and be peer leaders and you know, really lead by example and teach others.
So,
it's a big vision, a big undertaking, but it's my heart's calling right now, and
that's what I got to do. Really good.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And you do a podcast too. Did some teens follow your podcast?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So that's what
very good.
Yeah, it's over. It's on Ram Dass's network. It's the Indie Spirituals podcast. And I actually had you on earlier this year when your wonderful graphic book about the Dalai Lama came out.
Right? Oh, that's right.
Last year. I loved that book, by the way. So phenomenal. What I love is they give me a real freedom, since it is, you know, quote unquote indie spiritualist. I can have like a guest like you on one week, and then the singer of one of the most well-known punk rock bands. However, he's also into Krishna consciousness and meditation. They give me pretty much free reign as long as it falls under the umbrella of spirituality and well-being. And so when I keep it diverse like that, that does attract the teens. And so they might come to the show because of a musician they know, but then maybe they'll check out your podcast and learn more about the Dalai Lama and be like, oh, that's cool. So yeah, I just try to mix it up. And it's cool to know that I have listeners from teenagers up to people in their 60s and 70s, because I do. I just, to me, it's all relevant, you know, whether it's from younger generations, older generations. That's there's cool. so much to be learned.
How is the diet of those young people? Do you get into the food thing with them?
Yes. Well, and
bad foods, American food system that's messed up, toxic.
Yes, and that's what I absolutely love about this specific program is the founder of it. He is ahead of his time, because the programs I went through, it was like a step above jail food. And I've spent my time behind, you know, jail cells, so I know a thing or two about that. You know, I would then go through, I've been through rehabs, and it was like dry bread, government cheese, you know, Cisco food. What they get at this program, and I'm starting to see more of this across the nation, is they are actually getting organic farm-to-table food, and that is part of their education. Oh, yeah. The kids aren't fans of it, but I always make it a point to tell them, first of all, you're lucky, because if you ate the food I was eating in my programs, you would definitely not be complaining. But second of all, part of our well-being is based on what we're putting into our bodies. And so I love that the founder honors that and recognizes that. And so, you know, he's realistic. He knows once they leave there, they're not going to eat a diet every day of this. They're teens. They're going to eat pizza and ice cream. But the hope is that having the experience with this food and access to it, which most of them haven't, maybe yeah. they will start incorporating some of it into more of their meals.
Of course.
And
of course.
And really yeah, so I always stress the importance to them. I'm like, trust me, guys.
What is the what's the race thing in your work? Do you deal with a lot of black kids too, and Latinos? And
oh things? Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
it, mixed equal mix.
It's in the residential setting. It's probably it leans a little more towards Caucasian, but in my travels, it's completely a mixed bag, which is what I love. And it also helps me stay in touch with the fact that you have to approach different groups and different demographics in different ways. So that's why anytime, whether I'm speaking at a conference or I'm doing a workshop, I always go and of course I might have X, Y, and Z in mind that I want to discuss, but unless I'm giving a talk, if it's a workshop, I will always start by asking, you know, your name, where you're from, and most importantly, what brought you here today? And once I get through the room and I hear that, that helps me to kind of intuitively go in whatever direction I feel this room needs to start going. And it's just interactive and organic. And I'll tell you, 99% of the time, and this isn't because of me, it's because of the participants. I feel like we walk out of there feeling just a little bit more healed. You know, we really are able to lay that heart armor aside for those few hours and really get vulnerable and raw with one another and purge some things and laugh and cry and do some practices. And, you know, Bob, I was talking about this yesterday. I live week to week financially, but I would not trade that for the world, because I could never in a million years call what I do work. You know, it is my heart's passion and it can be draining. And there are times where I definitely don't fill my cup up enough, but I've gotten better at that balance, and what a gift it is. Like I said, it literally is a miracle that I'm still alive at 40. I can't tell you how many people I've lost, you know, to suicide, to addiction, to accidents.
Oh, that's terrible.
But it is.
And so now you're getting married now soon. Is that right? You mentioned that.
Yeah. And so, yeah, here I am, and I got engaged, and I'm getting married next year. And that's just part of the gift of taking care of myself, you know, is I have this incredible fiance I live with, and, you know, we live a modest life, but we have one another and we have what we need and we don't go hungry and we are able to go out and enjoy life. And
that's great.
It's
does she do a similar kind of work, or what does she do?
Yeah, she works actually it's really interesting. She works at a research facility where they do a lot of neuroscientific studies. And so they're doing a lot of research with things like medical marijuana or psilocybin or MDMA.
And, oh, really?
They have a lot of grants for this. And so they're working with a lot of people that have various mental health issues. And they're doing studies, and they're doing a lot of really important work. So,
she's a psychologist, in fact,
she's more of an assistant to them. But she's incredible. And that's why she's not in recovery herself like I am. She of course has done her share of substances, but she can have a beer occasionally, and she's fine with it. And God bless her soul. You know, she can do that. I can't, unfortunately. But it's great that we have such similar passions for helping other people in their healing journey. So
that is wonderful.
Not to mention we're both just quirky, but yeah.
Right? Yeah, I'm sure I wish you all the best, really, and a long life and everything. Is there any last thing you'd like to say, or any last question for me, or anything? I think we're getting to the time now.
Yeah, you know... Honestly, Bob, the last thing I want to say is just on a personal note to you. It's that I really do appreciate you, your work, your interest in the younger generation, and, you know, having conversations with people like me and introducing, you know, our dialogue to your listeners. Just as I'm honored, you know, when you came on my show and I can introduce your work to maybe some people that weren't familiar with your work. So this right here is what it's all about to me, is like, let's have these talks. Let's share this with as many people as we can and just be there for one another, regardless of what we believe. You know, we're all in this thing together. As Ram Dass says, we're all just walking each other home. So let's start acting like
that's
it.
That's right. Oh, that's good. Yeah. I like that. Okay. That's wonderful, Chris. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For taking the time.
Yeah. Thank you.
I wish you all the best and a long life with your beloved. What's the name of your beloved?
Her name is Lacey Ann.
Lacey Ann?
Yep. Lacey Ann. Yep.
Lacey Ann. So yeah. Chris and Lacey Ann.
Yeah.
Well, may you both flourish and have a wonderful life. Definitely. And keep up with the good work, and we'll talk again. Okay?
Oh, we absolutely will.
And I look forward to your book. And
thank you.
And if you need to reach out for any question about anything that I can be of help with, please let me know. Okay?
Then you shall be seeing an email from me sooner than later, I'm sure.
Okay, I will take you up on that. All right. Well, you take care. Okay?
You do the same. Thank you so much, Bob. Be well.
The Bob Thurman Podcast is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share and repost on your favorite social media platforms. Tashi Dilek, and thanks for tuning in.